He's in there laughing his ass off because he knows more about the law than you do.
I'm here live. I'm not a cat.
My law is thy legal.
I will make it legal.
Objection, Your Honor! Strangling a witness!
I'm going to allow it.
We disagree.
That's it? We disagree?
Well, I can't say we agree. That's how I lost my first 10 cases.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, a podcast that pairs a comedian with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 481. I'm Thomas. That's Andrew. How you doing, sir?
I am fantastic, Thomas. How are you?
I'm doing great. We've got a lot of fun stuff. We got Sidney Powell to talk about, possibly consequences for Sidney Powell, which is the important part, and a follow-up on the case where you said John Roberts was right and everybody else was wrong. I'm very curious to hear if you're changing your mind on that or not. And some more bank worms, possibly. A little bit of Andrew was wrong on bank worms and other stuff. We'll see if we can squeeze all that in. But here we go. Let's get right to it so we get to do all our segments.
Okay.
You betray the law!
Are there consequences ever for Sidney Powell and or any other horrible, corrupt lawyers that are doing really stupid stuff?
So the answer is a firm maybe. Okay? here's what's happened. In one of the lawsuits, this is William Feehan versus the Wisconsin Election Commission. This was the case saying that Wisconsin couldn't certify its election results because secret reasons. One of the defendants named, in addition to the Wisconsin Election Commission, was Governor Tony Evers. And he has now filed. That case is long since closed. It was ridiculous. You know, in short, it was a Sidney Powell lawsuit. And Tony Evers has now moved for sanctions and attorney's fees against Sidney Powell for, well, here, let me let him describe it. Quote, plaintiff and his attorneys advanced a lawsuit that, from its inception, was frivolous, dilatory, and without any merit. Plaintiff's complaint did not outline coherent legal claims, so much as it flitted among a variety of fringe conspiracy theories, sourced to anonymous declarations submitted by ostensible experts who were later identified and revealed to be extreme partisans with neither experience nor qualification to provide any type of opinion on the subject matter. At least one of the anonymous declarants was revealed not to be a declarant at all, having never agreed to the use of her words in this lawsuit. In sum, none of the quote evidence, end quote, and look, you rarely see sarcasm quotes in a pleading. None of the quote evidence offered by plaintiff had any relevance to Wisconsin's 2020 presidential election, and much of it did not meet other standards of admissibility. Compounding the through the looking glass experience of litigating this action, the arguments plaintiff's attorneys made during the case's short pendency were utterly bereft of legal foundation and in some instances foreclosed by binding precedent. That's paragraph one. And this motion for sanctions is 30 delightful pages long.
I'm just sitting here like chewing my fingernails of like, what does this say about my T3B answer this week? Oh, God. Did they need to give her a chance to withdraw the money? Oh, did I blow it? We'll see. Anyway, tune in later.
Absolutely. So Sidney Powell's response, this was filed on March 31st. We were going to cover it last week, ran out of time. But she still has another to the end of this week to respond. Believe me, we are going to cover her response to this motion because I am I'm positive it is going to be entertaining. The arguments here are really, really good arguments, and they cover the entire landscape. And again, I say this as somebody who has litigated and won sanctions. It's rare, but it happens. I want to tell you that in the context of that, I would be pleased to sign off on this sanctions motion. So what are the arguments that Tony Evers is making? They really fall into five separate buckets, okay? The first bucket is that they were grossly wrong on the facts, right? That they introduced into evidence things that were not evidence, and in general, were just terrible, terrible lawyers. This is often marked under the headline of engaged in vexatious and bad faith litigation. And this is, you know, the conspiracy theory stuff. And I want to tell you, if that's all this motion were, I would feel much less charitably inclined towards it. Not because Sidney Powell's not a crazy person, not because her arguments weren't terrible, but because courts give you wide latitude in how you argue your cases, right? Did it turn out you were wrong about a whole bunch of stuff? Yeah, but, you know, we don't want to discourage people from being able to bring meritorious lawsuits in the future that are nevertheless, you know, like at odds with what the official story is stating. And look, like, you could imagine that, again, you know, like if there was a legitimate government cover-up of something, and sometimes there are, right? Like that happens. You don't want to set a precedent that says, I want to deter a genuine whistleblower from bringing a genuine complaint. If that's all they had, I would say this is going to lose. This is not all they have. Ooh. So category number two are they're terrible lawyers as a matter of procedure. Right. That is, again and again, they did the kinds of things that no first or second year associate should do in connection with litigating cases. And the reason for that is Sidney Powell is not a lawyer. I mean, look, like, yes, you know, she can write Esquire after her name. She passed the bar in 1874 or whatever. Right. Like, but her job. Far more. So you could level, you want to level this criticism at me, go ahead. But, you know, I practice daily. Her job is to be an idiot talking head on TV.
Yep. And she's great at that.
Yeah. It's one of those, I'd say don't quit your day job. Yeah, and suck at that too, right? Yeah.
If that's her job, she's incredible at her job to be an idiot talking head. Yeah, she nails it.
But yeah, like the less actual law work you do, the more, well, here, let's read some of the stuff that fell through the cracks. Plaintiff's attorneys made several egregious procedural errors that inflated the time and expense necessary to defend this lawsuit. By the way, that's a really good argument for sanctions, right? Saying you suck at your job is not. But the fact that you suck at your job meant I had to do extra stuff, and that cost me and my client money is a good argument, right? I shouldn't have had to do this. So therefore, you should have to pay for it. They originally included a co-plaintiff who never consented to participating in the lawsuit. Well, that's bad. It was also apparent that the complaint was a recycled version of a different lawsuit. For example, the requested relief asked for production of 48 hours of security camera recordings of all rooms used in the voting process at the TCF Center. The only problem, quote, the TCF Center is located in Detroit, Michigan, and has no relevance to Wisconsin's 2020 election. These fundamental errors required the filing of an amended complaint, which in turn required review and analysis by defense counsel. But even the amended complaint contained errors, including that it failed to allege that plaintiff voted in the presidential election, which is an essential detail to establishing standing. These shortcomings were not limited to plaintiff's initial pleading. Plaintiff's attorneys also filed a motion for injunctive relief, but failed to include the order that it referenced. The certificate of service accompanying the motion failed to list addresses for service because at that time no defendant had yet filed an appearance, so CMECF, that is electronic filing, was not sufficient. In other words, if the defendant has not yet filed an appearance, when you file it electronically, their lawyers don't get a copy because the court doesn't know who those lawyers are yet. And though plaintiff's attorneys claimed to file documents under seal, they failed to do so and never requested in-camera review with that motion. The mistakes made in the first motion for injunctive relief necessitated the filing of a corrected motion, which the court explained was also not complete or correct as to form. Plaintiff's attorneys then filed an amended motion for injunctive relief, which for the third time was not in proper form, but was construed by the court in the plaintiff's favor. Attorney Powell, specifically Sidney Powell, filed motions without first filing an appearance and, upon notice from this court, filed an inaccurate appearance that claimed she still represented the removed co-plaintiff, right? Remember the person whose permission she did not get before adding to the lawsuit? Then, this goes on.
Boy, she is a really, really shitty lawyer.
Yeah. Then, following briefing and this court's decision on the matter, plaintiff's attorneys mishandled the appeal to the Seventh Circuit. They rushed to file before a judgment sufficient for appeal was entered, necessitating the subsequent filing of an amended notice of appeal and a motion to consolidate the two separate appeals. Without a doubt, plaintiff's attorneys unreasonably taxed the resources of the judicial system with their significant procedural errors. That's a really, really strong argument, right? And again, like,
that's several really strong arguments.
Yeah. Look, every lawyer I know has filed the wrong thing in the wrong spot, you know, clicked the wrong box on the, like, you know, we work hard.
Accidentally filed an age discrimination complaint against a hospital that had actually replaced the 50-year-old, just for example, I'm wondering.
We might get to that.
We'll get to that. Okay,
sorry. A court will give you a mulligan. They'll give you a second mulligan.
Really?
This was so bad that ultimately the court was like, Sidney Powell, we have tried to get you to file this pleading correctly twice in a row.
Yeah.
Whatever this thing is here, we're going to construe this as if you'd filed it correctly. The third category of events are, and again, if the second category is tied into,
wait, why we haven't finished all the categories of Sidney Powell sucks.
We're not halfway through.
Oh yeah. God.
Yeah. It gets better. So if the previous category helped explain why sanctions, like why monetary sanctions are appropriate remedial.
I hope, right? I never do my job so badly that we have different volumes and categories of why I suck at my job. Like, reasons you suck at your job, A through F, you know, G through, you know, I hope there aren't like an Encyclopedia Britannica of all the ways that I can't do my job. I hope there's just, you know, a handful of ways.
Yeah. So if we've established why sanctions are appropriate because everybody else had to spend more money because of how terrible they were at their job. This is the moral backbone for that. And that is they lied about the law. And this is not just me saying that. This is, right, the header is plaintiff's briefs misrepresented the law, which is accusing you of lying. The text is no less scathing. It says, briefs submitted by plaintiff's attorneys were riddled with egregious errors. They fabricated a quote and attributed it to an opinion by Judge Stattmuller. And then there's a citation to where it is in the docket. They argued, this one particular case established standing, quote, to challenge state laws that collectively reduce the value of one party, end of quote, without noting that the Supreme Court expressly overruled that case on that rationale. That's real bad. I can't explain to you how bad. Like, that is a Travis Wester level error, right? And they recklessly distorted governing law by relying on outdated precedent to argue notice-based pleading standards without acknowledging that the legal pleading standards changed drastically since 1987. This seems like, and I just need to do a little marginalia here. Morgan Stringer, Ace Associate, will be nodding along. If you are engaged in federal practice, you know that the Supreme Court's opinions in Iqbal and Trombley, okay?
Of course.
In Iqbal and Twombly, it's a hard word to say, completely changed the landscape of how you plead appropriate standing in federal court, right? It made it more robust. It made it easier for defendants to move to dismiss, because what you must do to survive a motion to dismiss in light of the Supreme Court's opinions in Iqbal and Twombly is that you have to plead at least some facts that suggest a right to relief that is, quote, beyond the speculative level, end of quote, right? So in other words, pre-Iqbal and Twombly, the courts would construe your pleadings as broadly as possible. And then in the early 2000s, the Supreme Court was like, okay, we're gonna narrow this down a little bit. And everybody who practices in federal court knows those two cases like the back of your hand. You would not. It is a mistake that it's a fireable offense to say, we meet the standard here because, and then cite to a 1987 case, because you know the Supreme Court intervened in Iqbal and Twombly. So it that's not something that you might not necessarily know, you know, as a non-lawyer, but every lawyer here is nodding along going, yeah, that's wow, super terrible. So this gross misstatement of law, along with the fake quote, the misleading citation to Whitford, evidence objective bad faith and exemplify the total hash that plaintiff's attorneys have made of this litigation.
Wow, total hash. Is that a total legal hash term?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Next, there's an entire subsection. This is subsection E that is stuff we talked about on OA. Plaintiff's attorneys filed this lawsuit without the support of credible, relevant, or remotely admissible evidence. Plaintiff's amended complaint relied upon the testimony of 13 purported experts and fact witnesses. Of those, five were anonymous, making verifying their credentials and asserting their qualifications and assessing their qualifications impossible. Indeed, it was impossible to know whether these affidavits were even verified by the affiants as required by federal law. Consequently, these affidavits were inadmissible, as plaintiff's attorneys knew or should have known. We mentioned all of that. Two of these anonymous experts were later revealed to lack all credibility. You know who these two anonymous experts are? Spider and Terpsichore.
Yeah.
And it goes through, Spider blames plaintiff's lawyers, right? That is Sidney Powell, for making the inaccurate assertions about, you know, him being an electronic intelligence analyst under the 305th Military Intelligence Division, secret Agent Orange. Oh, as it turns out, right, I'm a mechanic.
Does Spider have to file a motion to, like, stop being called Spider in the court? Like, this is a dumb thing. I got it. Nope, sorry. You're known as Spider in this court until you file the correct motion.
How great would that be? Like, he'll be
motion
like
to
74.
Not be referred to as Spider.
Then Terpsichore claimed China was somehow involved with Dominion voting systems and affected Wisconsin's presidential election results. That individual, and tell me they didn't listen to our show. That individual was later revealed to be a pro-Trump podcaster who had previously lied about being a medical doctor and having both a PhD and an MBA. She was found to have unlawfully misspent raised funds and solicited donations. The judge in that case ordered her to pay more than $25,000. The podcaster had never spoken to any of plaintiff's attorneys or agreed to the use of her declaration in this suit or others brought by the plaintiff's legal teams. And then they go through it. The other witnesses that we didn't cover are, I'll do this at a super high level. It says there is no greater credibility in the eight declarations and purported expert witnesses for whom identities were given. For example, Exhibit 3 is a report from Matthew Brainerd, who discussed a survey that he maintained uncovered assorted irregularities in Wisconsin's election results, but his only identified education was degree in business administration. Brainerd failed to provide any sampling method, telephone protocols, scripts used by interviewers, quality control steps, information about who conducted the phone calls, or information about how the voter telephone numbers were located and verified. In short, Brainerd's survey had none of the indicia of reliability necessary to admit survey evidence. So he did some kind of like goofball survey of calling Trump supporters saying, hey man, did you vote for Trump? Really? Okay. Well, right. And he's a, you know, got a degree in business administration, not statistics. The declaration from William Briggs is based on Brainerd's survey results. The affidavit from Joseph Altman purports to recreate a conversation he purportedly overheard in which someone he speculates was a Dominion employee made representations about the 2020 election. Altman layers speculation on top of hearsay to promote a conspiracy theory about election manipulation. I could go through. We have no qualifications. We have the declaration about elections in Venezuela. Okay, the evidence was super bad. And then,
so
and
another
then
volume
finally,
of How She Sucks at Her Job, Volume 4, I think we're on.
That was 4. This is 5.
Oh, 5. Okay.
Yep. Most of plaintiffs' requests for relief were unprecedented and impossible to grant. So, without any legal support, plaintiff asked this court to unilaterally and counterfactually declare that Donald Trump had won Wisconsin's presidential election. Plaintiff and his attorneys did not ask for a new election or to have the legislators select electors like other lawsuits requested.
Yeah.
Instead, they just asked this court to do that by fiat over overriding the will of
Fix it. Fix it all. Yep. Make Trump win. Cool. That doesn't sound very lawyery.
No. Also, they requested an order enjoining Governor Evers from transmitting the certified election results to the Electoral College, which had already occurred by the time the lawsuit was filed. Now, you've asked about this in the context of the T3BE question. So let me answer that. Your T3BE question is governed by Rule 11 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. We're going to talk about that. This is not a request under Rule 11. This is a request under the court's inherent sanctioning authority, which is repeated routinely throughout the case law, which says that district courts possess inherent powers not conferred by rule or statute to manage their own affairs to achieve the orderly and expeditious disposition of cases. That includes the ability to fashion an appropriate sanction for conduct which abuses the judicial process, right? That can include harassment, unnecessary delay, needless increase in the cost of litigation, willful disobedience, and recklessly making a frivolous claim. And they have asked for relief under the under 28 U.S.C. section 1927, which says an attorney who so multiplies the proceedings in any case unreasonably and vexatiously may be required by the court to satisfy personally the excess costs, expenses, and attorney's fees reasonably incurred because of such conduct. So that's what they've asked for. If the court grants it, then what they will do is come up with a bill of costs. And that bill of costs will say, right, the court will say, okay, we're going to reimburse you for, you know, the following things that you had to file that you shouldn't have had to file. And then they'll get to submit all of their legal bills. And if the court grants the relief, by the way, the last section of the brief argues that plaintiff and his attorney should be held jointly and severally liable for sanctions. So that is, they can go after the named plaintiff, who probably doesn't have any money, or they can go after millionaire Sidney Powell, who definitely does have money, and then force Powell to go after her client to make up the difference, which, you know, no lawyer is going to do. So, I'm very, very excited in watching what – I mean, the great part is going to be Sidney Powell, unhinged lunatic, responding to what you just heard, pretty aggressive language describing the conduct of Sidney Powell, unhinged
lunatic. I'm just sad that the best outcome is sanctions. I feel like prison time is warranted here. Like, why is that? How bad can sanctions get? What are sanctions?
Look – you could, as part of sanctions, right, like hold somebody in civil contempt, except that this case is closed. So there's no reason to do that. So she will not be serving prison time as a result of this. But look, if Sidney Powell has to write a $50,000 check to the governor of Wisconsin, that will be glorious. And that's not it probably won't be as high as 50,000, but that's not an impossible outcome here. So we'll continue to watch, but this was delightful to read, and I just had to share it with you.
It was delightful to listen to. This podcast is brought to you by the X Chair. I love my new X chair. I am sitting in it right now, and you folks probably know I spend a lot of time sitting in a chair, whether it's recording away, streaming, editing, and I have never had an office chair that looks and feels so amazing in my entire life. It's so comfortable, I can sit for hours, and I have to, and never feel uncomfortable. The secret is not only their patented dynamic variable lumbar DVL support, which offers unbelievable lumbar support to my lower back. But now, thanks to their new XHMT technology, I can also get heat and massage therapy while I'm sitting in my desk. If you're someone like me who has to spend a lot of time sitting down in your office chair, you might want to try this XHMT stuff. It delivers heat and massage technology right to your core. It increases blood flow, muscle recovery, and energy. These are all perks that make working from home or the office a joy. It even has four different massage modes and a fast-warming heat technology for when I'm sore. You won't believe the X chair difference until you feel it for yourself. So the X chair is on sale now for $100 off. Go to xchairoa.com now. That's the letter X, chair, and the letters O and A.com. Or call 1-844-4X-CHAIR. X-Chair has a 30-day guarantee of complete comfort, and you can finance your purchase for as little as $30 a month. Go to xchairoa.com now and use code XWheels for free X-Wheel blade casters. That's xchairoa.com. Go there now.
What I hear when I'm being yelled at is people caring loudly at me.
So, what's our follow-up on episode 473, in which you talked about how John Roberts was right and the rest of the court was wrong? It seemed pretty convincing to me, but have you changed your mind?
I have not, but I received a lengthy letter from Ryan Jane, who is a staff attorney at the Freedom From Religion Foundation, our friends over there at FFRF, and I take seriously what he had to say. So I want to read that letter and engage with his arguments, his points on the air. So this is about our discussion in episode 473 in praise of John Roberts of the Uzwegbanam decision, Uzwegbanam versus Prishevsky. And this was an 8-1 decision in which John Roberts was on the bottom. And I argued that he was right, and I continue to believe that. So this case involved two students at Georgia Gwinnett College, Chike Uzwegbanam and Joseph Bradford, who were students at Georgia Gwinnett who wanted to proselytize, who ran afoul of certain restrictions for proselytizing on campus, and then during the scope of the litigation, during the pendency of that litigation, the school said, you know what, we're going to change that policy. We agree, you're right, we're wrong, we're going to change that policy. And the question is one of standing, right? Is once there is no longer an active case or controversy, should the court continue to weigh in? The 8-justice majority said yes, and their reason was because the case also requested nominal damages. It said, yeah, we want a vindication that we were right, and we want you to pay us $1 as proof that we were right. And John Roberts said that turns the court into advice columnists. We cannot save a moot case or controversy by asking for $1. I would place a higher value on Article 3, and I therefore dissent. So now, with that as background, here are the issues that are raised in Ryan's email. So he starts off with two things that I think we agree on. One, there should not be any formalistic games in litigation that you can lose because you aren't aware of little tricks. You sold Thomas on this regarding the need to plead nominal damages. But if Roberts had his way, the problem still exists, but in another form. If you forget to plead compensatory damages, even though you won't be able to prove any, you can lose if your injunctive relief is mooted. That's just one example, but the point is that that's not what's at issue in this case. These dumb tricks need to get fixed, but they're there with or without this case.
Hmm.
Not true. Okay, ooh. So let me be explicit here. You're sort of arguing the contrapositive of what I'm arguing. I am saying right now, in every case where litigants are seeking only a declaratory judgment. And by the way, I've litigated these cases all the time, right? And let me give you a classic example in contract disputes, which is my bread and butter. You have an ongoing relationship. My client is unhappy with the contract and says, you know what? Out of an abundance of caution, This contract runs for another 10 years. I think I've got the right to withdraw from it, but I'm not going to withdraw, cause you damage, make you sue me, then potentially lose. I'm going to go to court and I'm going to get a declaratory judgment that says, yeah, the contract is void. And until I get that judgment, I'm going to continue to abide by the contract, right? That way I'm not causing you any real damages. It is a live case or controversy because we disagree over how to interpret the contract, and we're going to the court to get declaratory relief. Again, this is the kind of thing litigants do every single day across the country. And you plead only a request for declaratory relief. I've never pled a request for nominal damages in those cases. It will now be malpractice to not tack on a nonsense claim for nominal damages in each and every one of those cases, right? Because if they change the contract, if they change the policy and it moots the case, I now have a citation that allows me to continue to go forward so long as I've pled a complaint for nominal damages. So I disagree with this first point. Like, I'm not saying that had the court gone the other way, it would have solved all issues of like pleading nonsense and formalistic games. But I'm saying this opinion will result in a change to practice that overcomplicates, that moves away. Right. And again, one of the themes of opening arguments since episode one is let's move away from whereby the party of the first part doth witnesseth to the party of the second part, right? Like the kinds of magic words that people think the law is, and move towards common sense applications. Now saying, I have to explain to my clients, like, why do we have this separate count for nominal damages in here? Well, because the Supreme Court says, and right, like, I can't explain it in lay English as to what it's supposed to do. It just becomes a bit of formalism that's now complicating practice. So I disagree with that point. Okay. Then he says, bad faith governmental actors regarding whether their policy change is genuine can be dealt with in other ways. No argument there. Also not at issue in this case. I'm glad we agree on that, but I think that dividing line is going to be where I come out, you know, when we get to the things that we disagree over. But that's correct. This case does not, right? There are multiple ways in which one of the counter arguments, and maybe this is what he's thinking about, one of the counter arguments that you might get in response is, oh, Chief Justice Roberts, you're incentivizing a bad faith defendant to like make them litigate, get halfway through, then say, oh, we're going to change the policy, moot out the case, and then change it back again. And then, you know, kind of continuing to be, you know, Lucy pulling the football away from Charlie Brown. You may have made that point when we were discussing the case, but Ryan is agreeing with me that is not the issue here. There is no dispute that Georgia Gwinnett College sincerely changed its mind. And in the event that there is bad faith acting, there are lots of, right, that doesn't moot a dispute, right? Because you have the capable of repetition yet evading review standard, right? You have a bunch of different ways to be able to go back and say to the court, like, Your Honor, that they changed their mind last time, they're going to do it again. So it doesn't render it moot. So it's only a good faith change that really does render it moot. So I'm glad we agree on that part. Now, the new points. First, Ryan says, you didn't mention this case's strange bedfellows with the likes of the Alliance Defending Freedom and us, the FFRF, both submitting amici in support of petitioners. The reason is that even though these particular facts make you feel bad for the college for having to defend a policy they've given up on, or else admit that their old policy caused constitutional harm, Roberts' solution leads to an even worse result, which is easier to see when the facts are flipped. And I'm going to get into that flipping of the facts in a second. I think it is very interesting that the ADF and the FFRF were on the same sides here. Huh. I think we alluded to that a little bit in the sense that it does not surprise me to see the FFRF on the other side of this case, because as we pointed out, generally speaking, liberals tend to be more skeptical of how this court in particular has used standing as a bar to litigants. And I am well aware. And again, I think this also applies to other niche advocacy groups like the ADF, who have a history of getting bounced from cases on standing, right? So if we brought Ryan or Andrew Seidel on and said, hey, how many times have you been bounced out of court on standing? They, you know, they would roll their eyes and be like, yeah, that happens to us all the time. So we're super skeptical about standing. So I'm not surprised at that. I should have pointed out that sort of unique alignment, because I think that that's very interesting, and it does not neatly fall on the category of, you know, lefties skeptical of standing, righties pro enforcing, you know, expanding the doctrine of standing to keep litigants out of court. Okay, now let's see what he envisions as the flipped result. He says, suppose you have a state governor that flagrantly and openly violates your First Amendment rights. Take our case against Texas Governor Abbott, where he ordered a public display to be taken down simply because he didn't like it. Or worse yet, suppose a police chief sends a squad of cops to his ex-wife's house, tells them the code to get inside, where they ransack her house, terrifying and embarrassing her, but causing no direct monetary damages. Well, that last one, I think, is kind of hard, right? Like, you ransack the house, there's going to be economic damages, But let's work with it. In both cases, suppose in the final stages of an appeal, the government adopts a new policy that prohibits the conduct in question. Should the plaintiff call this a win and go home with their dollar? You said that seeking only a declaratory judgment is the definition of an advisory opinion. I think that's out of context, right? Like, I'm defending DJs. So if I said that, if it came across that way, I certainly don't agree with that. So what is a person supposed to do when the government causes you very real harm, but it's not money harm, so you don't plead compensatory damages? Well, I think what you do there is sue to get the government to change its policy. And I think if they sincerely change their policy, then you've gotten the thing that you want, right? And I get it. And so I think that where we live here is in the gray zone between your experience as boots on the ground, which, you know, look, I will reiterate, if you're not a member of FFRF, go sign up today. They are doing fantastic work.
I am a member of FFRF.
Yeah, me too. They are doing boots on the ground work that is more important now than ever in light of where our Supreme Court is. So I get that. And I certainly get the kind of underlying mistrust of saying, oh, you know, we'll change our mind at the 11th hour. And I think that maybe there is an argument that you sort of, we can move the fraud standard down a little bit, right? Like all of those are real possibilities. But I think about, I got to tell you, what I keep coming back to was we had Andrew Seidel on to discuss the Trinity Lutheran decision. And you may recall, Thomas, I know you recall this, I picked Trinity Lutheran for our 2016 You Be the Supreme Court, right? Hmm. Because I thought it was controversial, but very, very clear what the law was in light of the Washington opinion, that ultimately the Supreme Court was going to come down the other way. And the oral argument was a disaster. And the reason that the oral argument was a disaster, well, first, the oral argument was a disaster. We had Andrew Seidel on, and I said, I'm not too worried about that. Oral arguments aren't that important. Mm-hmm. And Andrew Seidel said, yeah, but this was real, real bad. I was there, and you need to know. And it turned out it went 7-2 the other way in a way that I could not have envisioned. And we asked Andrew for his evaluation, which has stuck with me to this day. He said, yeah, well, that's because the state of Missouri declined to enforce, like nobody wanted, they'd changed their mind. They'd admitted Trinity Lutheran to the competition by the time this case was there. We'd had a change in the governorship. So nobody wanted to defend this policy at all. And so as a result, they did an unbelievably terrible job at the Supreme Court and were left with this awful, awful opinion because no one was there to put any time or emotional energy or intellectual energy into defending something that they agreed with anymore. And I think Andrew summed that up as sort of like the classic lawyer's aphorism of, you know, bad facts make bad law. And that has really stuck with me. Right. And so I think it makes it in a situation where somebody is going through the rigmarole of trying to defend a policy that they agree is wrong, it just opens up so much more potential for terrible opinions like Trinity Lutheran than the contrary. So that's where I draw that dividing line. I recognize, right? And so why I wanted to read Ryan's stuff on the air. He's got one more point that I think illustrates sort of the difference in our backgrounds. And again, really, really good point. He says, finally, in some cases, civil rights attorneys who take cases pro bono have no way to get paid. And that's true, right? Mm. You will typically say you have to have a judgment on the merits. The other nuances with this, and this email is already too long, but I want to get my initial thoughts to you. Would love to discuss more or hear counter arguments. I agree with you. You've got the social problem of getting pro bono work paid through having a prevailing verdict, right? Through prevailing at trial and on appeal. I think on balance, I consider it a win when the FFRF gets a school to take down a sectarian religious display or sign. I think it's a win when you get a school district to change a policy. And I don't think we need to preserve that as a live case or controversy with this, you know, fiction rigmarole of nominal damages. But I love giving voice. I didn't give voice to the arguments on the other side, right? Because it was already 8-1, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you guys won. We were sort of already, you know, I was taking up the, it's me and John Roberts alone on the island. But there is the case for the mainstream, you know, and how I interact with it.
Wrong, sir. Wrong. Wrong, sir.
Andrew Torres
is wrong. 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 Wrong.
All right. Well, that leaves us enough time for Andrew was wrong about bankworms.
Yeah. This comes from longtime listener Irene Johnson. I'm just going to read it because this is delightful. So Irene says, hi, Thomas and Andrew. Here's some information about bankworms. First, the bank itself was purchased and dismantled by Deutsche Bank in 2000. So unless there's still vestiges of it, bankworms lives on only in the annals of jurisprudence. Love that. In French, worms is pronounced verms with a long O, and yes, the S is pronounced. A hint for French pronunciation in the future, the letter W is generally pronounced like an English V. Okay,
cool. Yeah, you said that. You got that right.
Yep. Surprisingly, verms is actually tangentially related to the English word worm. Bank Verms was founded in 1928. I love this. Was founded in 1928 by a guy named Hippolyte Verms.
Yep.
Verms being his last name. The name Verms is from the Alsace-Lorraine region of France, where the local dialects are sort of halfway between French and German. And yeah, a bunch of people wanted to write in and talk about the German city of Verms and the Diet of Verms, yeah. Which we did make reference to.
When she said long O, is that more like Vorms or...
Oh, I guess. Yeah, that could be Worms.
Yeah,
all right, I'm gonna say.
Yeah, I don't Worms. Know. Something like that.
In the Middle Ages, the word worm meant snake or dragon in German and gave rise to the Old English worm with a Y, which referred to both snakes and worms.
Hmm.
You may have noticed that dragons and snakes are sometimes referred to as worms in literature, which I have. Thomas is right that if you watch a show in French or turn on French subtitles, you'll recognize a lot of English words. That's in large part because although English is technically a Germanic language, it derives a great deal of its vocabulary from the French, over 60%, according to some linguists. Well, I did not know that.
It's not totally what I was saying, but that's fine. I was talking about idioms and the other language, like how we have idioms that we would say, you know, deja vu or, you know, that's what yeah. I was talking about. Like, yeah, we were watching the show. I actually brought it up on the Q&A, the investigation, and there are certain English phrases that they said. I wasn't talking about like actual words, but that's okay. Either way,
well,
still interesting.
And I love this bit of pedantry. And I mean that in the best possible way. After the conquest of England by William of Normandy in 1066, the English court was run by the Normans / French for a couple hundred years. And Anglo-Norman was spoken in the law courts, schools, and universities. A lot of French words came to replace or live alongside their English counterparts, giving the English language an extremely rich vocabulary. Well, that was delightful. Great follow-up on Bank Verm.
Bank of Orms. Yeah, good stuff.
Thank you so much, Irene.
And another, I don't know what you were wrong about. That's just kind of a fun follow-up. But what is there, were you wrong about something on Lessig and fractional votes?
That we I was 100% wrong on this. Okay. Super quickly, and I've got the link to one of his articles in the show notes. This was an interview he gave with the Harvard Crimson. And I think it is a severe impediment to the thing that Professor Lessig wants to do. And that is he wants to award fractional electoral votes. So it would avoid some of the issues we talked about as a follow-up, but I think that the text of the Constitution and its history would foreclose on that. So perhaps
so what thing were you wrong about then? What did you say?
I did not realize that he wanted a fractional allocation of each electoral vote.
Okay.
Because right, a vote.
And this
corresponds,
is from, we just kind of talked about how the math would work,
right,
and so
exactly.
We're describing it as one being the minimum. But I guess for him, it wouldn't necessarily be the minimum that you would assign.
Yeah, you could get 0.23 electoral votes.
How do you decide how many decimals to go?
Yeah, and forgetting that, like, it is clear to me, and again, you know, maybe Professor Bode is listening to this one and will, you know, use it as proof of my latent Scaliaism. An electoral vote is a person, right? It's a person casting a ballot. I don't know how you
chop
cast
up some people.
can't make an omelet without chopping up a few electors.
Originalists are like, you have to. Sorry. The Constitution says you have to chop up people if you want fractional votes.
So, but I was wrong on that. I'm continuing to look into it. We will revisit the national popular vote, I think, very, very soon, because I've got some additional thoughts on
but
that.
But you still disagree. So you the reason you kind of assumed that he wouldn't be using fractional votes is because, in your opinion, it doesn't seem like it would be very constitutional. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it makes it a harder argument.
Gotcha.
At the Supreme Court. Yeah.
So it's kind of about you were trying to get his argument as good as it could be in your mind.
Yep. That's what I was trying to do.
All right. Well, Bonk of Orms and fractional votes. Fun little Andrew was not, I don't know. You're barely wrong about it. Andrew was wrong. But we like to be accountable, obviously, and great feedback. This was kind of a feedback show a little bit. So that was fun. Opening Arguments is brought to you by Paint Your Life. I love Paint Your Life. I talk about this every time. The painting that I have of Lydia and our beautiful daughter Phoebe on the beach. It's one of my favorite things that we have in our house. It will be on any wall wherever we live as long as we are alive. It is that beautiful and it's that meaningful. And if you have somebody, wife, grandparent, maybe your parents. If you have somebody you're shopping for the perfect birthday, wedding gift, anniversary gift, I highly recommend Paint Your Life. Here's how it works. You get a professional hand-painted portrait created from any photo at a truly affordable price. You choose from a team of world-class artists and work with them until every detail is perfect. The user-friendly platform lets you order a custom-made, hand-painted portrait in less than 5 minutes. It's a quick and easy process, and you get that hand-painted portrait in about 3 weeks. You send them any picture, or even combine photos, to make the perfect painting. At paintyourlife.com, there's no risk. If you don't love the final painting, your money is refunded, guaranteed. And right now, as a limited-time offer, get 20% off your painting. That's right, 20% off, and free shipping. To get this special offer, text the word OA to 64,000. That's OA to the number 64,000. Text OA to 64,000. Paint Your Life. Celebrate the moments that matter most. Terms apply. Available at paintyourlife.com/terms. And one more time, text OA to 64,000.
And thank you!
And now it's time to thank our Hall of Famers, our all-time greats, our best top patrons on patreon.com/law, enjoying all the goodies, the lot awful movies, the questioning in the Patreon Q&A that we just did, all that good stuff. And I will start us off. Thanks to Sean McGovern, John Brockman, Lisa, see you at the next True Crime Podcast Festival, Magatozy. I like that. So once we, you know, a month finishes, then we get some new additions to this list. So those were who made it after this month. And now we're at Tell Morgan, Gatom's son, Amy Hensley, January 20 baby, Matt Gates eats his chicken wings with ranch, Zach Bloom, any chance of an Optimus Prime v Negatron debate soon, ? Ray, Legal Eagle is so handsome. Cecil said Tom would officiate my wedding, I'm pretty sure. California employment, work, accident, or litigation questions, call or text attorney David Nitka, 310-776-5879. Again, 310-776-5879. By the way, I'd officiate a wedding if someone wanted to. I don't know why anyone would want me to, but...
You can do that in California.
Might as well. Yeah, why not? Richard Scott, The Smiths, Chris Kaiser, Brian K. No, Mr. Gates, that's not what a facial challenge means. Ooh. Praise be unto Hamilton. Sure. Sparkle Donkey Tequila, the world's best tequila in the world. See the documentary at sparkledonkey.com. It's better than Hamilton. Fort Teaser. Two Virginians and an immigrant walk into a room, diametrically opposed foes. Okay. Listening for years, still can't come up with something clever. Rest in peace, Brandon Bernard. We must abolish the death penalty. Adam Borchoff, Justice for Beer, The Coterie, Business Success with Salesforce. Find us at thecoterie.io. Budget Botanist on Fiverr, considering announcing a plant of the week in my Patreon name. Oh, we'd love that. Level Up Canine, take your dog to the next level. Memphis area dog trainers. Becoming a patron to get 5 episodes a week, and I finally caught up on months of backlog. New book, Greatest Gift of All, A Logical Path from Religion to Humanism by Mark McLean, out now. Counter target spell. If that spell is countered in this way, put that card in its owner's hand instead of their graveyard. Draw a card. Yeah, I already got that one. Give me another. I know it's Remand, but hey, give me another card. But if it's super obscure, I obviously won't know it. But, you know, I'm learning. Why aren't we calling the January 6th insurrection an act of treason? Well, I mean, yeah, we do, don't we? I like my pork streaks paired with at Casa Agria and at Emperor's Brewery beer. Josh Hawley's dorm room poster. Lee Sharp. Can we get a deep dive on Chevron Corp v. Donziger? It involves Chevron owing billions in damages and a lawyer subject to indefinite... And that cuts off. GD Tree says, in bird culture, this is considered a dick move. Thomas Kleberg, seriously, F the Arkansas legislature. Trevor Project is available at 1-866-488-7386. Trans kids are loved. Absolutely great message there. And yes, F the Arkansas legislature. Buddy freaking Geyerson. Q was right. See Matt Gates. Yeah, no kidding. Isn't that funny? All the Q stuff is about, like, you know, sex trafficking, and it's all right wingers who are guilty of that. And then they're like, okay, but still, say Hillary Clinton with a pizza place. If Trump gets indicted, Sassy Italy Tours wants Andrew to come to our world HQ on the Eastern Shore for some parole. Do I not get to come on? Am I not invited? Jeez, that hurts.
I think that was lack of space. That's clearly an invitation probably. To both of us.
I'll be your
I'm not going without you, so.
Aw, thanks, buddy. Same would go for you if anyone ever invited me to anything without you. Idea for a screenplay, Air Bud Man's Best Amicus. Hard on, guns aren't just for the right. Love from a progressive liberal with a CCW. That's fine, but I hate guns. Two fabulous lesbians who will send a fully armed battalion to remind you of our love. Da 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 da. Yeah, it's good stuff. Edgy Veggie, Bob Newhouse, me fail bar exam. That's illegal. Once Mark Cookie sent cutters, Ledo Lebion Fabuleux, Jennifer Chikowski. A republic, if you can keep it. A string of unconstitutional laws. Maybe if we just call that place Dakota Territory again, they will stop sending people to D.C. My call. Sorry, Andrew. Uncle Frank is too far gone. Say it with me. Amicus. The Books That Burn podcast. Reviewing fictional depictions of trauma since 2019. Nuzzly Fuzzly Torsten Peel at the Satanic Temple. Yes. I'm not even a tortfeasor and I'm kicking your ass. Greg Kreimer. Angry Macface. Penelope is ranting about Terpsichore's cryptography. Today I learned if a horse isn't from the Champagne region of France, it has to be called a sparkling donkey. Two patrons who just welcomed a tiny future OA listener into the world. Congrats. Coming in low is part of every textbook approach. It's just something you have to do when you land. Airplane 2. I move for a good podcast thingy. Beers in the beer fridge. Torts in the tort freezer. K. Zachary Michaels. And last but not least, our all-time great, the one, the only... Now that we've jumped the shark with Cop Rock, there is a courtroom scene in the Transformers movie. Not saying,
Indeed there is. Yeah.
Murray Gregerson. Apparently the COVID vaccine causes constipation. When I got mine, they told me I had to wait 3 weeks to get number two. Simple Country, Hyper Chicken, Crazy Corgi, Pizza Gates, and Legal Weed in New York. What a week. No reasonable person could believe that I wanted to sell that baby. Plug whatever you guys want here. I don't listen anyways. Patreon benefits rule. Brent Medling, Seattle Pete, Jake, Medicon 7, another Minneapolitan, waiting for our live show in Minneapolis. Is Tort short for Tortellini? And Christopher Brown, your turn, Andrew.
And thank you to a fabulous single French lesbian patiently waiting to be eligible for the vaccine. Stop. Ask a question the cat lawyer would ask. Lawfulcopter says, Andrew and Thomas, from the bottom of my heart, thank you for everything you guys do. Thank you so much. I won't change my name till Thomas porks something. A man was sued after his snapping turtle attacked someone. They sued for tortoise interference. I'm just saying, technically, Andrew Seidel's butt sat for the bar exam. Odin thinks Thomas should take a break from the bar exam to do more MPRE questions.
Ugh. What are those?
Yeah, I think that is the multi-state professional responsibility. I don't know. I didn't have to take that one, so.
Yeah. So you don't have any professional responsibility. Cool.
I had to take a separate professional responsibility exam in D.C. to wave in there because Maryland has so low ethics. Anyway, Polly Hernandez, Robert M., I want Lautobots in form and roll out merch. Tautology is an anagram of tautology. Aspen Live Show. Calling for a You Were Wrong About crossover episode. It's the only way I can convert my sister to your podcast. Ian Hamilton, to the tune of Camptown Races, there's a bear that we all know, Yogi, Yogi. There's a bear that we all know, Yogi, Yogi Bear. All right.
Okay, sure. Is that a Hamilton song? I don't know.
Jason Copas, that's a big Twinkie. Excellent. Emily Rainbow Spence, Hotspur's ode to a small lump of filibuster I found in my armpit one midsummer morning. Earth Court 6, Gates Gate. Robert Coburn, a series of houses, each more glass than the last. I love that. Nate Drex, not that Chris Wallace. Darth Mandy Pants, insert a personal story here. Give to modestneeds.org. Give to modestneeds.org. Seriously, give to modestneeds.org. Jennifer Cratch, waterboarding is my favorite torture. Coffee boarding is a close second. 13th century Saxony gravel truck lawyer. I'm fully vaccinated and the 5G download speeds are amazing. Diogenes the Cynic was right. Jeff Gelbach, dude. I, Andrew Torres, am not fantastic. What kind of maniac says they're fantastic as often as I do? Huh? Me. Don't take legal advice from a cat. CivilPoliticsRadio.com, Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Valley Free Radio. John Bilderback, ever so slightly hopeful that we can have nice things again. Yeah, I think you should be. Stephen Balticate Sandoval, has anyone told Justice Breyer that he keeps his full salary when he retires? Yeah, a lot of speculation on that. We'll talk about it on the show. Philip Kaiser, Andrea, the arbitrary and capricious. It's spring and time for me brew much beer. All hail beer. All hail beer. Criminals who use commas get longer sentences. Oh, God. Oh, that's so bad. Like Absion, Alfred Wallace, Payne Strumpet. Never underestimate the perversity of machinery or the machinery of perversity. Jonathan, Trump wanted four seasons, got Doubletree. Karaoke legend Cosmo, cue the music, was born in a hospital in Norwood, Massachusetts, blues. Lawsuit bracket, O'Rourke versus Dominion or Nunes versus a fake cow, vote now. Milo Mead song, messed up the April Fool's joke. Join your labor union together, we bargain alone, we beg. Clean up serious opening beans in space live show in Chicago. Yeah, we could definitely do that. Labels are unproductive, and if you use one, you're an idiot. An octogenarian turtle who gets sued is a tortfeasor geezer. False. If D&D Minus wants to try the Alien RPG, I will run it. Anonymous. WordOrigins.org, your source for legal terms from 13th century Saxony. My witty names aren't original, and my original names aren't witty. Nerdgnostic, RIP, Notorious RBG. Our kitchen is your kitchen for an eventual Seattle live show platinum dinner. The offer stands. Yeah, we know. Believe me, we will get to Seattle eventually. Derek, my planned multi-week nester bit has been rendered unfunny by Gatesgate. Big Easy Blasphemy. It's kind of nice having a competent federal government again. SummitShuffleboard.com. That sponsored that sentiment, which we agree with. A String of Unpronounceable Characters. RondoTheDork.com. HPL. Oh, H.P. Lovecraft is my favorite racist science fiction author. P.K.D. Philip K. Dick is a close second. And you know, Heinlein deserves to be on that list somewhere, right? Malika Chandler, Tricicular Manslaughter, Soggy Pants. The liberal originalist says that all laws that mention religion must be explicitly disrespectful of it. Adam Costa, Jay Aldenwald, Sakashite struggles to come up with a pithy Patreon name each week. How does Noah manage a whole diatribe? Adopt a homeless pet and a post-declawing and ear docking. Day jury belly at Packy's at last, baby. Heather L. Matthew Vernon. Got my name change in too late last week, and someone used the same joke as me. Curses. Jeremiah's Fancy Microwave Emporium. Ian and Allie. Danny Rosari. Eli Bosnick. David in Brooklyn. Teresa Gomez. Sam Donnell. Mitchell. No commute so behind on podcast. Fun fact, Australia had a war on emus. The emus won. I agree with that 100%, and Hamilton cop rocks. Natasha Crunchwrap wants you to support the Justice Policy Institute. Sam Buck, and of course, our all-time great, he who shall never be dethroned, Conrad Michaels.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
And now it's time for T3BE. This whole time I've been wondering if this... It sounds like you're saying the Sydney Powell thing is a different rule, I guess, because the hypothetical was in federal court. I don't know. We'll see. How did I do?
All right. So this is 50-year-old nurse hires a lawyer, says, hey, I was fired for age discrimination. I want to sue the hospital. Lawyer runs out, files a complaint. But as it turns out on the facts, and I want to take a tiny sidebar here.
I was going to as well on this particular thing.
So it says, the question says, as it turned out, the hospital had hired a 52-year-old man as the nurse's replacement, a fact that rendered an age discrimination claim unavailable.
Yeah.
Now, in reality, I don't know that would be the case, right? Like I would hope you would not. Yeah, exactly.
I was just thinking about in terms of race. I was like, what about, okay, let's say you fight, let's say you're a racist. So, you know, you're like a Trump voter and let's say you run a business and you fire a black man because you think he acts a certain way that you don't like. But then you like hire another black person that you think acts more like the way, you know, wouldn't that still be racial discrimination in a way, even though you hired a black replacement technically?
Yep, absolutely. And you could hire a 52-year-old that looks 30, right?
Like
we see this all the time in Title VII litigation involving now, you know, discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity, right? Where in the past it was, you know, we fired a woman for appearing, you know, too butch. Mm. That's actually language used in some Title VII opinions. I apologize for that. Right. And then you hire, you know,
sure,
someone who meets the traditional notions, classical notions of femininity.
I'm glad we did this because I was thinking, you know, that didn't sound right, but I was willing, because it's a bar question, I've been willing to just say, okay, I'll take at the word that it's going to be unavailable. And that didn't really affect the question, did it?
It does not. But it underscores, as I was going to make this point on last week's very difficult conspiracy question.
Yeah. Right?
People are still talking about it. And we had somebody, I'm forgetting your name, but a shout out in the OA Facebook community who said, well, look, I teach this subject for practice bar exams all the time. And you just need to know, like, when the hypothetical says there's no meeting of the minds. Yeah.
Yeah. I know. That is something I have really struggled with and I need to get better at in this test. There are times when it's like, I just need to realize the bar is kind of giving me insight into mental states in a way that in real life you'd have to argue about it, right? You'd be like,
exactly,
well, what are you talking about? But the bar exam sometimes will just be like, here's the mental state and I need to just take it at its word, you know? And yeah, sometimes
otherwise they'd have no answers.
Yeah, right, yeah. Right, right. Sometimes you can't take it as a non-lawyer. It feels like sometimes there is a dispute, but sometimes I need to identify that the question is doing that when it's doing that. And I've been bad at that.
You'll get better. Okay. So the fact pattern tells us that this made this a bad claim.
Sure.
Right?
A bad court thingy.
A bad court thingy. And then it says, the hospital responded to the complaint by filing a motion for sanctions against the nurse's attorney. Is the court likely to grant the motion? You immediately eliminated A. No, because sanctions are not proper against the attorney of a represented party. That's clown-horning nonsense.
Okay,
We just did half an episode, right? Like, of course sanctions can be proper against an attorney. And in fact, we're going to talk about the specific rule of civil procedure that governs when you can move for sanctions against the other side's attorneys. So A is nonsense. You also eliminated D. Yes, because the nurse's complaint contained legal contentions that were not warranted by existing law based on the facts in this case. That's not a great answer.
It felt a little too permissive of sanctions to me, like a little too far.
So,
you know, is that right or no?
Well, let's get to the rule. So the rule is Rule 11 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. And you'll see why this could have been raised against Sidney Powell as well. And they chose not to. Rule 11 is when you challenge a pleading that a lawyer submits in court. Okay. So it says every pleading, written motion, and other paper must be signed by at least one attorney of record or by the party personally if the party is unrepresented. That paper, you know, must identify who it is. Why do we have to sign it? Because this, and that's so subsection A says you got to sign it. Subsection B says, by presenting to the court a pleading, an attorney certifies that to the best of that person's knowledge, information, and belief, formed after an inquiry reasonable under the circumstances, the following four things. One, it is not being presented for any improper purpose, such as to harass, cause unnecessary delay, or needlessly increase the cost of litigation. Two, the claims, defenses, and other legal contentions are warranted by existing law or by a non-frivolous argument for extending, modifying, or reversing existing law or establishing new law. Right? Three, the factual contentions have evidentiary support or, if specifically so identified, will likely have evidentiary support after a reasonable opportunity for discovery. And four, the denials of factual contentions are warranted by the evidence or, if specifically so identified, are reasonably based on belief or a lack of information. So what does that mean? That means you can't file garbage pleadings.
Sure.
Okay. And garbage pleadings are ones that you know are designed to harass, are based on bad law, are based on facts that either have no support and could never have support or are false. And the key question here in terms of D, right? Because the way in which D would apply would be, look, you should have known that they fired your client but replaced him with somebody even older. So this is a bad court thingy. Mm-hmm. And the question is, what's an inquiry reasonable under the circumstances? And I have to say, I think even without the procedural defect that we're about to talk about in a minute, I think it's reasonable to say you can go into court and file a complaint and say, on information and belief, they fired my client because he was 50. I've made the prima facie case. That is, my claim is warranted by existing law. The question is, how much do I have to know about what their defense is before filing a lawsuit?
Right.
And I don't think you have to know their defense before filing the lawsuit, right? Because when they say, right, but we now have a non-discriminatory reason in that we replaced your client with somebody who's even older, well, now
the burden shifts back to me.
Yeah. Exactly right. Now, in light of that, the two remaining answers were B and C.
Oh, so you did eliminate D.
So we do eliminate D. That's why we go through. C was yes, because the nurse's attorney failed to conduct a reasonable pre-filing inquiry. And as I just set forth, I think that's the best yes answer. But Thomas, you picked B. B is 100% correct.
And I got it wrong.
Correct.
All right. Another wrong answer, everybody. Another
absolutely correct.
Hey,
absolutely
I got it right.
Correct.
Play the music.
You are correct. The best kind of correct.
He's not even a lawyer and he's kicking your ass.
You said no because the hospital failed to give the attorney the chance to withdraw the complaint in advance of filing the motion with the court. This is how Rule 11 sanctions are litigated.
Yeah.
What you do is you send your motion over to the other side and give them a reasonable time to withdraw. This is subsection C. It says,
yeah,
if after notice and a reasonable opportunity to respond, the court determines that the rule has been violated, the court may impose an appropriate sanction on any attorney, law firm, or party that violated the rule or is responsible for the violation. Absent exceptional circumstances, a law firm must be held jointly responsible for a violation committed by its partner, associate, or employee. A motion must be made separately and must describe the conduct. It must be served to the other side, but may not be filed or presented to the court if the challenged paper, claim, defense, contention, or denial is withdrawn or appropriately corrected within 21 days after service or within another time that the court sets. If warranted, the court may award the prevailing party after reasonable expenses, including attorney's fees incurred for the motion. So think of how sensible that is, right? And look, it's super frustrating when you feel like the other side is acting in bad faith. But what it means is you give them, you say, hey, look, I've tried to get you to stop this. This is our motion for sanctions. We're going to file this in 3 weeks if you don't withdraw your nonsense pleading. Mm-hmm. And here's all the facts on the basis thereof. And then they have 3 weeks to look at it and go, yeah, all right. Or nope, line in the sand. We're ready to go back to court and fight about this.
Yeah.
And they didn't do that here. They just said, and so, you know, because you can have this kind of what seems like an honest mistake. And I have been involved and it would not be inappropriate for the other side. It'd be a little bit of a jerk move, but it would not be inappropriate for the other side to write back and be like, we're going to file Rule 11 sanctions if you don't withdraw your complaint because it's going to be deficient as a matter of law because of facts X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm. And I would look at that and go, yeah, all right. You know, especially because the omniscient fact pattern has said I'm going to lose. I'm going to withdraw here. So no opportunity was made to correct. You correctly surmise that there must be said opportunity. You got it right. Good work.
All right. Nailed it. That's 1 out of 20. I don't know. My percentage is so bad now. But we're going to see when the dust settles on the porked exam and if I can sanction Andrew. I'll give him a chance, of course, to withdraw his pork test first so that, you know.
Agreed.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's find out who this week's big winner is. Hop in that time machine, Andrew.
Well, Thomas, this week's winner is Hacksaw on Twitter, who writes, "Hello, nurse. B, 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 B." I love the Animaniacs call out. I wanted to get in my yakko there. And short, sweet, to the point. Also, I like that apparently his first name is Hack. Everyone give Hacksaw a follow. That is at Mr. The Saw, at MrTheSaw on Twitter. And congratulations, Hack, on being this week's winner.
And that's our show. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. We will see you next time.
I move for a bad court thingy.
You mean a mistrial?
Yeah, that's why you're the judge and I'm the law talking guy.
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it will be a big help if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/yodelmountain and follow us on Twitter at openargs. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. It is produced with the assistance of transcriptionist Heather Loveridge, production assistant Ashley Smith, and additional contributions from Morgan Stringer and Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our live shows and heads up the OA Wiki. Follow at OA Wiki on Twitter. Additional thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community: Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian Ziegenhagen, and Teresa. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith, who edits the show and created the fabulous theme music, which was used with permission.